This is Scott Becker with the Becker's Healthcare Podcast. Thrilled today to be joined by one of the most successful venture capital investors of the last couple decades. We're joined today by Mark Selkow. Mark's a general partner at Costa Nova Ventures. He's had incredible success there. He's worked with some really interesting companies. He's also a Stanford graduate, a Brown University graduate, and so forth and so on. Just a brilliant person. Mark, take a moment and tell us a little bit about your career, and probably more so, what are you excited about today? What do you see out there today that excites you? What do you see the future of venture investing today?
Yeah, well, it's really nice to be with you and your listeners. Thanks for having me. So you're right. I'm a partner at Costa Nova, and we're an early stage B2B software investment firm. So we invest as early as the formation of a new company and idea through the first or second round of the financing. And I've been at Costa Nova for about 6 years. And before that, I co-founded and ran two companies, software companies. And so I come to venture capital from having been a founder and leader myself. And I think that helps me do my job effectively. What am I most excited about? There's in my work life and then in my personal life, which I'll focus more on the work. On the personal life, I'm using COVID to try to learn jazz guitar. And it's super hard, but I'm really enjoying the challenge. And then I'm trying to learn Spanish because I'm doing some Latin American fintech investing. So I've got some quests over there. But at work, I invest in early stage application, business applications, SaaS applications, mostly ones that are enabled by AI or machine learning. And the second thing I'm active in is fintech. And within fintech, I specialize in insurance and benefits and to some extent payment and lending technology. And the thing most recently that I've been spending time on is financial solutions and tools for Latin America and Africa based on the idea that these markets are poorly served by legacy financial products, you know, really like high growth, rising middle class opportunities. And I'm really enjoying that. So that's me, and that's what I'm excited about these days.
I'm going to talk to you a little bit about learning another language at whatever age you are today, plus learning jazz. I mean, they say it's so hard to learn another language when you get past your, let's say, 10 to 20 years old. And I assume you're past 20 years old because you graduated from Brown a long time ago. How are you going about trying to learn a new language today and learning jazz today? How is that? How are you going about that?
Yeah. Well, I would say learning how to be an early stage investor is also learning a new language. So I'm like on the steep part of the learning curve in all areas of my, and I've got three teenagers. So I'm learning about how to manage that as well. So the life lessons are flowing abundantly in my world. Learning a new music instrument, learning a new foreign language is super hard as an adult. And I'm sure that neurochemistry and the brain scientists have, you know, understood how, like, you know, when the wiring is done, it's harder, and you know, the cement's getting drier and drier as you age. I don't understand the science of it, but I can tell you that I do find it really stimulating to face that challenge, and it takes a lot of muscle and a lot of perseverance. But I guess that's my way of staving off aging and mortality, and that's my line. I'm gonna stick with it.
But talk about that, because as age a little bit. I mean, I was literally on a phone call with somebody I know forever, and I had to remember his name again. It was like, oh my goodness, I'm losing it. But how much do you think it, like, keeps this new learning keeps the brain healthy and keeps you sort of healthier and is a fight against aging and all those things?
I think that's true. You know, I read the pop science and the, you know, the major newspapers and in my monthly magazines. And so, I can't say that I've read things at a scientific level, but my sense is that, you know, engagement and being active, it, you know, helps keep you sharp. And, you know, I'm lucky in the sense that I enjoy it. So I'm going to do it for that, for the enjoyment benefit. But if there's a secondary medical, benefit, I'm going to choose to believe that too.
Fantastic. And talk about early stage investing. How early stage are you looking at? And originally, you folks did so much in technology and healthcare and so forth, and now it's, I guess, a lot of fintech as well. What does that look like for some of these other economies, for Latin America, for Africa? What does that look like? What are I mean, talk a little bit about that and what that looks like.
Yeah.
How do you find deals to invest in? Are they deals here that are serving those parts of the world, or are they deals there that you're investing in? How do you navigate some of that?
Yeah. So just focusing on the international part of what I do, which is not the totality of it, but it's a recent priority. It is it's been enabled by, you know, remote, you know, Zoom and Google Meet kind of culture, where if you're not going to get together with someone in person anyway, you may as well find talented people wherever they are. And that opened our aperture. And, you know, we thinking from a fundamentals perspective, we believed in the thesis of the opportunities in these countries. So, we're meeting folks and we're comfortable making decisions, you know, having not met them in person. And so then, we run our normal playbook as early stage investors, which involves evaluating the market opportunity, evaluating the theory of the product. And in some cases, they have a product or a demo or, an MVP. But in some cases, when we invest really early, like at company formation or before the entrepreneurs even quit their day job, which is what, two of the last few things I've actually done. Then it's more the idea of the product and how it fits with the market opportunity. And then the third thing, which I'd say by far is the most important, is the character of the founder. And, we really fundamentally invest in people. And if we believe that this person understands the problem deeply, is going to be able to attract and retain a great team, and they've got the attributes that you need to be an entrepreneur, which is a perseverance and intelligence and great customer facing skills and good judgment, and then of course pass the integrity and honor test, then we are very comfortable investing at an early stage, because venture capital is a high risk business. A lot of times things don't go the way you expect, but a few times they do, and that delivers the results.
You had mentioned that you'd been the founder of a couple different software firms. Talk a little bit about that, and then the transition to general partner Costa Noa. What did that life and transition look like?
Yeah, this is something I've really thought about a lot. Learning to be an investor, like I'm learning to be a jazz guitarist, is a different. It's a new skill. So being an operator, which is the vocabulary, but I never called myself an operator when I did it, but VCs call it an operator. That meant like I had a job at the company that I founded. Was involved knowing our company, our team, our customers, the use cases for our product really deeply. It was really deep. I understood the details. I was very close to it. We were kind of doing one thing really well, the kind of hedgehog sort of model. And I really enjoyed that. I felt like in control of my domain and had a lot of substance behind, the decisions that we made. In venture and a lot of control and authority, because I was in fact the boss. The things that are different in being an investor is we just don't, we don't work at the companies, we're investors in them. We don't have the depth of knowledge. And because I might invest in a lending enablement tech company in Mexico City, and then a health savings account bank in the US, and then a mobile insurance brokerage company in Egypt, I'm never going to know as deeply. So I try to get as smart as I can, as quickly as I can, and then have to size up the people. So that's one thing. It's not as deep. The second thing is around that control and authority. It's not our company. It's the founder's company. They're the managers. The management teams are the ones who have all of the knowledge. So understanding where those boundaries are so that I can fulfill my role as a fiduciary, a board member, if I am a board member, or just an investor, where I can ask the hard questions and provide as much help and support as I can. That's important. While at the same time, it's really important not to overstep. And I had an inclination in my first few years as an investor to, believe I had a little more authority than I did. And I learned that lesson. And now I think I've found that line. But that took a little figuring out, because I, was trained in, being the leader of my own company. So I hope that's getting at the question that you're asking, Scott.
No, I quite frankly think it's brilliant. And it is. There's so much this issue of, it used to be said about physicians, and a spouse would say jokingly, well, my spouse is a great physician, but not a great investor. And it was sort of jokingly, and often it was wrong, because often the physicians were actually very good at the investing on the side as well. But now you come into a whole different world where you're talking about founders of businesses, often selling them for, nine figures plus, 100 million plus. And then they have to become investors. And moving from being a founder, an operator, really deeply in that business, to becoming an investor or a serial entrepreneur, take a moment on some of those challenges, because I don't think people understand how difficult that can be, becoming sort of a success as an investor, a success as another, as an entrepreneur in another business, not the one you were so deeply involved in. People think it's easy, but it's really hard. Can you talk about that for a moment?
It's very hard. And it's also hard to know how you're doing for quite a while. Because if you invest at the early stages, you need a lot of chapters to play out to know whether you made a good decision early on, whether when you invested. But I think you're rightly pointing out that the thing that's really different and new for me as an investor is investment judgment. You know, the kind of the rubber hits the road when you decide, with all the information you've gathered in your diligence period and all the, you know, relationship formation and assessing you did of a founder, yes or no, am I going to invest in this or not? And those are fundamentally subjective judgment calls. And my experience, you know, working with investors before I became one and now that I am one, is it just so happens that there's a distribution there too. Some people are just remarkable investors. They just have a knack for seeing where the puck is going. They have a knack for assessing people who really can make it as first-time founders and those who can't. And there are people who are equally intelligent, equally experienced, who for whatever reason just aren't as good when it comes to the judgment calls. It's an intangible thing. Maybe it's like great athletes. There are some people who just can do things other people can't do, and you're not sure why, because everyone's training equally hard. And you know, it's one of the questions I ask myself, like, how is my investment judgment? And I'd say one thing that we try to practice in our firm, I think we do a good job of it, is focus on growth, focus on retrospective analysis. When we made mistakes, why did we make the mistakes? Were we just unlucky, or was there a pattern? And when we got things right, why? Was there something we did that helped us make the right decision, or did we just get lucky? And the best thing we can do is assess, and we do that as often as we can, just so that we can, you know, try to be the best judges of investments as we can be.
I mean, just fascinating. And when you look at size of investment today, how small or big are these seed rounds, Series A rounds? And when you talk about investment judgment, do you find it's more important for you to, you know, judge the entrepreneur? Or is it more important to judge their idea and where they're going? Where do you, like, I just had.
Yeah.
Where do you put
focus on? Yeah. So on the first question, in our world, which is early stage software, at seed, it could be as little as, let's say, $500,000 invested, or as much as $5 million. It's a pretty big range. And some of it depends on that market and what they need to build. You know, in that next chapter, some have really small capital needs, some have bigger, but that's roughly the amount that we invest. There are other, like, at company formation, a life sciences, like pharmaceutical, biotech company might require tens of millions, or, you know, something that's in hardware, because they have those capital needs. But for us, it's, call it 500K to 5 million. And then, yeah, is it more the market? Is it more the person? And I think it is a combination of three things: market, product and theory of product, and person. And if I were to rank them, person would be number one, because a great person could take a mediocre market and turn it into a real company and a succeeding company, you know. But someone who really isn't fit to be, I won't say bad person, but like not fit to be a successful founder, is going to get overwhelmed and struggle and not be able to make the hard decisions and retain a team in this climate. So we always put person number one, and then probably market number two, because once you pick the market, you know, it's a big decision to move away and pick a different market. You can change your product in the world of software. You can modify it. You can jettison it and start anew. So product would be third, but it's on the list. So we spend a lot of time and energy assessing people and assessing markets.
When you look at markets, is it how niche a market are you typically looking at? I mean, how niche down does that market have to be that you're choosing? And what are the parameters of it? Is it Can we win in the market? Is it worth winning in? How much else has already been done in there? What's competition look like? How do you assess a market?
Yeah, this is a really important question for early stage investors. So we look at the size of the market. So if you do a really great job, is it big enough to deliver venture returns? Frankly, most companies that get started don't need to deliver venture returns to, create a life-changing result for the founder. They just shouldn't raise venture capital. But for venture capital investment, it needs to be of a certain size. And by that, I mean in the billions of a market opportunity. It doesn't mean you'll sell that much, of course, but that's the opportunity. Then we look at the nature of demand. So who is the customer? Who is the buyer? How acute is the problem? How urgently do they need to solve it? What do the alternatives look like? Can you really price the product in such a way that you can capture that value in the market, or the alternatives so good? Classic kind of business school five forces stuff. And how likely is the customer to adopt and switch and deprecate their old solutions? We look at all of that and we build a market map. But generally, bigger, better, power customers. There are certain roles when you're selling to a business that have more power. They just get the budget every year. And there are certain roles that are not as powerful and they have a harder time getting the budget. So you want to sell to certain buyers in a big market where the problem is really sharp, just to oversimplify it.
And when you're talking about software investing, how much is it based on an old 80-20 rule? What you really need is a software seller, selling software as a service, selling software. Are you looking for a handful of large customers that are going to become big adopters of your software, or is it more democratized? And I know it's going to differ a little bit from company to company, but on average, what do you look for? When you led founded software companies, were you aiming for 50 magnificent customers that spent a ton, or is it much more, no, we need thousands of customers all spending X amount on a subscription level?
Yeah. The conventional wisdom in software is there's a go-to-market strategy is pick your segment. Are you going for big enterprise? Are you going for mid-market? Or are you going for kind of smaller businesses, of which there are many different kinds and flavors? You can't do them all. You got to pick one. And I'd say from our firm's perspective, we think great businesses can be built attacking any of those three segments. What matters then is that the founder and the idea have really thought through how to build their go-to-market operation based on the segment they've chosen. So it's always a worry if they say, well, we're going to go after these two or all three. That isn't going to succeed because you got to choose when your resources are so constrained in the early stages. And then the second thing is, this is how we'll build our sales team, a marketing operation. Here's how we're going to go acquire customers based on the segment we've chosen. So the best answer I can give you, Scott, is we don't believe enterprise is better than mid-market or vice versa. The company idea and the product idea just has to fit the segment that the company is prioritizing, and their go-to-market strategy has to fit as well.
And so let me ask you this question, and just to see how translatable is it to other markets. Would it be easier to get a foothold in a mid-market size business, where you're selling to small restaurant chains or individual restaurants like that, but maybe much bigger upside if you could be an enterprise type of program like a Salesforce, something like that? How do you sort of view those two things? In so many businesses, it's easier to pick up smaller customers, but there's much less upside in the long run. Are there analogs in the software business?
There are. This is much discussed in our industry. Like, does the law of gravity or anti-gravity apply? So, for instance, do you sell to the mid-market, and then as you build out your product and your reputation, your referenceability, do you then go upmarket to enterprise? So that would be anti-gravity. Or do you sell to the biggest, like banks and telcos and insurance companies and industrial conglomerates, and get the credibility and the, frankly, the lucrative contracts, and then go down market to mid market with all of that heft? So that would be the law of gravity, because you go down. I've seen companies go either way. Investors and founders argue about which is better. And I don't have a strong perspective that one over the other is better. It is quite hard in my view, to focus on like small Main Street businesses and then go up market. Similarly hard to go down. I think SME, particularly Main Street style businesses, like you mentioned, restaurants, are there's so many. It's such a big opportunity, but it's so distinct in what it is. My view is you got to focus there and stay there. But between like a $75 million Midwestern industrial company, and then you're going to sell to a you know, GE or Honeywell, like that makes a lot more sense that you could choose one or the other and then migrate.
Fascinating. And when you built your companies originally, before you were general partner, Coach Noah, and so forth, were you focused on enterprise or more niche applications? What was your own business? Not that it's here nor there in terms of investing in other businesses, but what were your businesses?
Yep. So the first business was a 1990s Web 1.0 consumer e-commerce company. It was called Baby Center. So it was a website for pregnant women and new moms and dads. And we had editorial content and advertising. So our customers were big brands like Pampers and J&J. And then we had an e-commerce store. It was like Amazon for, you know, strollers and high chairs and sippy cups. And, you know, our customer was the consumer in that business. So we, you know, we had some enterprise customers like calling on Unilever and Procter & Gamble to buy, you know, sponsorships and advertising. And then we had consumer customers. So that was the first. The second was quite different. It was called Merced Systems. And we sold to very large enterprises. And our product was performance management software for high turnover workforces. So call centers, field service, like guys and gals in vans who repaired stuff, and financial back office, people processing insurance claims and mortgage applications. So high turnover hourly workforces. And our customers were very large banks and telcos and insurance companies. And our contracts were large. They, on average, they were $1.5 million in software value. And so those were long sales cycles. We needed a very sophisticated salesperson in a regional territory. I mean, to be honest with you, I really enjoyed all of those models. And so I'm diverse in the, you know, companies I've invested in today. I am on the board of a company that sells to auto dealerships, and I'm on the board of a company that sells to government agencies, and I'm on the, you know, board of a company that sells to small employers, and I'm on the board of a company that sells to, you know, really large insurance carriers. So all of the above.
And let me ask you a question. I know that for different size companies, the sales cycles are very different. If you're selling enterprise to GMC, you're looking at a very serious sales cycle, a very sophisticated sales team, to even get them to even take a look at it and think about it. Then it's until they embrace it and serve it for a long time. And so the sales cycles can be very different. What about the software engineering teams behind a big enterprise type software you're selling, it's $1.5 million, somebody's going to invest with you versus something where somebody's spending $20,000 a year with you. Is there a distinction in the software engineering team? I know there's a difference in the sales team because I've seen it in different businesses that we've been involved in. You know, what we think of as relationship, high touch relationship sales teams versus transactional sales teams. And some companies have a lot of both versus an engineering team. What do software engineering teams look like? Do they differ based on what you're going after?
They kind of don't, is the honest answer, but the work that they need to do is different. So if you're selling to smaller customers, it's often called like a higher velocity sale where, you know, the customers can decide in, you know, days or weeks or maybe even hours. You're mainly building a product that doesn't change for each individual customer. The customer might try it and buy it, and then you just ship new features based on your market research. And each customer, if they have individual demands around a feature, they can submit it, but you're probably not going to prioritize it, over other things. When you're selling to a large enterprise customer, especially if that customer is spending millions of dollars a year with you, first of all, large enterprises have very exacting requirements around security and scalability, and how you integrate into their environments with like single sign-on and user administration. And so there's a lot of that kind of work that you just have to get right and invest in. So there are teams that focus on that. And when customers spend that much money with you, they want their specific feature requests prioritized. And so figuring out how to best do that and how the teams have to respond is just it's a heavier weight set of responsibilities. So you might have similar skills in the engineering team, but the flow of the work can be different.
And the interface with the customer might be different as well. I mean, very much so, versus very, very custom driven for the specific big customer versus a little bit closer to off the shelf for the smaller customer. And how
That's
you
right.
interface with both those is so critical. Mark, I know I've taken more time.
Yep.
Go ahead. No, you go ahead.
Oh, I just say on the, I think I totally agree with what you said. My second company with the big customers, we always wanted our engineers to get to know the customer and vice versa, so that they really had a sense of why, what, you know, the things they were building were so important to the customer. And that was something we just couldn't do at the, you know, higher velocity environment.
Fantastic. Mark, I know I've taken up much more time of yours than I expected, but you're just fantastic and so educational, so informative. Thank you so much for joining us, and just a magnificent set of funds that you folks have built. I think you're on your fourth fund, and just incredible what Coach Noah has done. It's been a pleasure getting to know more about you and Coach Noah. Thank you very much.
Great. My pleasure. Thank you so much for inviting me.